Hallo alle zusammen. Mal eine kurze Frage voraus. Die Folien sind auf Englisch. Und daher den Vortrag kann ich entweder Deutsch oder Englisch halten. Ehrlich gesagt, wäre mir das Englische lieber, weil ich da nicht ständig hin her springen muss. Aber überlasse ich euch. Also Deutsch, Englisch. Können wir uns auf Englisch einigen? Okay, dann let's do the talk in English. Makes it easier. Okay, so. Topic is the evolution of an open source manager for virtualized clusters. The Kubernetes project. And yeah, that quote is pretty much the canonical quote to dig up when we are talking about virtualization. It's just too tempting to use it. So, what am I going to talking about? First, what is Kubernetes? Then we go to the different versions 1.0, 1.1, 1.2, 1.2.0, 2.1, which is the current release, and look into the future and what else is there. Now, a short overview of what the project is all about. As already mentioned, it's an open source cluster manager for virtualized clusters. Okay, that's quite a handful, so what does that mean actually? We are combining virtualization and real-time disk replication and use that to offer high availability and much better resource usage. Keep in mind that this overview describes the current state of affairs. We weren't at that stage 4 years ago. The whole thing is written in Python. We are using OpenSSL, Xen, KVM, DBD, LVM, and various other Linux standard tools. It is fully developed inside Google, and as of August 2007, has been open sourced. We are still developing it pretty much mostly with Google employees internally, and an open repository. It is mostly used inside Google, and to the best of our knowledge, there are quite a number of external users. Since we do not do polls or require registration or anything, all the information we have is about our external users is what the people disclose themselves in mailing lists or what you can guess at. It's licensed as GPL version 2. Fine. So the very first experiments that was going to become Xen cluster were started outside of the SCM, resource control management. When that got to the point where one could actually do something with it, we decided, yeah, now we better get the source code a bit under control and checked it into Perforce, which is the resource code control system we use at Google. That was March 2006. It was 4,000 lines of code, completely written in Python. It was a very, very thin layer and basically on top of LVM and Xen, pretty much automating all the commands that one usually had to do by hand. So create logical volumes, write a Xen config file, start a Xen instance, stop it, stuff like that. At that point in time, it supported Xen 2.0.7, which was the bleeding edge at this point in time, or at least the first version that really properly worked and could be used for production purposes. And development commenced then properly. 2006 or 2020, we could release Xen cluster 1.0, the first, shall we say, proper release. Code jumped up to about 8K lines of code. And we got it working. So what does it actually do? It's a very thin layer on top of LVM and the Xen command line at that point in time. So we have nodes, those are hosting instances, and we have one master node, which acts as the controller. The master node has all the configuration data, all the commands that run from the master node, and so on. Of course, that means if the master node dies, it would be bad. Therefore, the very first version already included the capability for the master node to be failed over. So master node dies, fine, fail the rollover to one of the surviving nodes, and you can keep going. The instance disks are backed by straight logical volumes. Nothing fancy, just create a logical volume and attach it as an instance disk. To create actual instances and have something running inside them, to be useful, we had what we at that point already called instance OS templates. Basically, Xen cluster would create the instance disks, then would call out to a script with arguments, here, this is the instance name, this is the first disk device, do something with it, to get an operating system on it. So in the easiest case, you just grab an image file and write it straight to the block device, or use dbootstrap, whatever. That's up to the script. At that point in time, the OS template scripts supported a single operation that was create. Instance Migrate was available, but not in the way that you'd usually expect it to work. Instance Migrate basically meant, okay, stop the instance, copy the data from the current host over to the target host, start the instance again. And to have
okay, that works. Okay, to survive instance failures, or node failure, sorry, we had an instance backup. The idea was basically you stop the instance, you copy the data, the logical volume, over to the other host as a ready-to-run copy, and then that node dies, you fail it over, which means starting the instance from the backed-up data. As I said, very, very simple, but serviceable. So what did we actually use this damn thing for? The original design target was to support Office Infrastructure Services. That's the usual stuff that basically an IT company needs to support in Office running. DNS servers, LDAP, web caches, web servers, printing, Kerberos, the list goes on. And use it as virtual instances. Normally a lot of that stuff would run on dedicated machines due to separate administrative domains, security separation, and so on. This means you have a stack of machines this high when you're done. That gets kind of expensive, and most of those machines are basically just idling. Yeah. So the idea was, okay, use virtualization and compress the whole stack down. The usual arguments of virtualization apply. So that way, we managed to drastically compress the actual footprint of the Office infrastructure. With Xen, the overhead for the virtualization was pretty low, as opposed to VMware. And with the backup feature, we actually had a reasonable chance to survive hardware failures. Yes, you probably had a state from last Friday or something, but at least you could switch it on and keep going. You didn't have to send somebody around with a CD-ROM into it somewhere and reinstall the machine. Of course, that wasn't exactly a satisfying state of affairs for long, so development kept going. At that point, we also decided, yeah, Xenclos is kind of a very generic name, and we may or may not get in a bit of trademark trouble with Xen or not. So, get a proper name, one that's unique, and that preferably isn't used by somebody else, so we don't get in any trouble. What we came up with was Ganeti. At that point in time, when you drop Ganeti into a Google search, you found, I think, no hits or one or two hits, something totally and utterly obscure. So we figured that's a good name. It actually doesn't really mean anything. It's just a name that was not in use, in case you were wondering. So at that point in time, the current operational experiences and our long-term planning went into development strategy. Interestingly, when you look back on the project history, a lot of the features that went into the current and last versions of Ganeti were actually discussed way back in 2007, 2006 in the initial planning, as in, okay, suppose we keep this project for quite some time going, get the necessary development time, yada, yada, yada. That's what we want to do one day. Yeah, it's total pipe dreams, guy, and yeah, we may never get there, but we shall try. Turns out we got there. Nice. So in 2007, February, we released Ganeti 1.1. Code had grown to about 12,000 lines at that point in time. Why did it grow so far? Well, we got us some real disk replication using DRBD07. That gave us real-time disk replication, which meant that if the node your instance was running on died, you could switch over and had the state of affairs on the disk as they were just before the disk failure or node failure, or the state of last Friday. That's nice. So from the point of view of the instance, if the node or disk dies, that just looks eight. Somebody took the power. I'm just back in business right now. Fine. Makes things a lot easier. Also, DRBD offered us, well, in the stack we used then, this nice feature, online disk replacement. So what happens? Nodes dies, and far more often, disks die. It's a fact of nature. This stuff just dies. With DRBD, what we could do is, so if it each instance has, with DRBD, two disks, one on the primary, one on the secondary. If anyone dies, well, we still have a copy. So yeah, we could do a disk replacement. We could allocate a new disk on the node where the disk died, on another node, link it into the DRPD structure, sync the data over, drop the dead disk. All of this would happen without the instance noticing anything, making disk replacements transparent. No time to stop things, so a disk died. Well, the instance never knows it. Makes for much smoother operations. Since we now have disk replication traffic, which potentially can flood the network quite terribly, we figured, yeah, we probably do not want to mix regular operational traffic and the disk traffic, which, by the way, is in plain text anyway, on the same interfaces. So, Ganetti 1.1 supported using a dedicated network interface for the replica traffic. So the recommended setup is to use two network interfaces on all nodes. One is connected to the outside world, where all the regular traffic goes over, and the other interface is just local to the Ganetti cluster, and it's used for the replica traffic. We are also switching from Xen 2.0 to 3.0, the series, and this gains us SMP support, which by the time it arrived in Xen. As in SMP support for instances, instances could use more than one CPU. We also made instances a bit more flexible and added the ability to change the memory and CPU allocation. Of course, that was not an on-the-fly change. It means you change the instance, and then you schedule a reboot window, reboot the instance. That means actually shut it down completely, because we have to rewrite the Xen config, and start it again, and it comes up with the new CPU and memory allocation. Also, we added console access. There's this nice XM console command that we wrapped around, which makes debugging a hell of a lot easier. You no longer have to guess, okay, the instance is started. XMList tells me it's running, but I cannot connect. What the hell is going on? So you can now instance console and take a look at the instance console and find out, oh, there was a FASM check. It failed and it's now asking for the root password. Oops. At least now you know what's going on. We also added the XC watcher as a background process regular scheduled by cron every 5 minutes or so, that we look into the configuration. Okay, what instance do we have? Which of those instances are supposed to be running? And which of those instances are actually running? And let's do something about it. It would ignore all instances that were supposed to be down but running, but any instances that were supposed to be running but down, it would, and presumably be crashed, it would try to restart. To avoid getting in an infinite loop, it would only try to restart them, I think, 3 or 5 times and then abandon them. Okay, if you really don't want to run, well, I can't do magic. The succeeding versions 1.1.1 to 1.1.9 pretty much focused on robustness improvements. Because, yeah, at that time, we used it more and more, and from operational experience, yeah, that breaks in an interesting way. Now we need to, at this patch, to actually work around this particular failure mode and so on. That's pretty much what we did during the 1.1 series. We converted the office infrastructure clusters to actually use replicated disks, which made us way more survivable. As I said, the disk replication was a significant gain in reliability and availability. Again, one of the things we could do, online disk replacement, being able to actually survive disk failures and so on. So, since the office infrastructure clusters were working really well and served quite a bit of money, we decided, okay, we could actually expand that and go for general service clusters, which pretty much meant, yeah, I need a machine to do something. Why don't you use a Ganetti cluster? And we give you an instance. That's pretty much what we did. And it kept growing from there quite a lot. Also, in the 1.1 series, the trial by fire, also known as the disk death incident. All over the world, where we had Ganetti clusters deployed, disks kept dying. And not just the normal, yeah, once in a while, a disk dies, but disks kept dying a lot. For quite some time, we had no idea what the hell was going on. Kept dying, got replaced, more died again, got replaced. And finally, it turned out, yeah, there was actually a hardware issue with disks, as done by the disk manufacturer. And it sucks, because there's pretty much nothing you can do anything about, except by getting the manufacturer to notice it replace them with hopefully non-broken disks and finally get rid of all the broken disks. Interesting enough, real-time replication, disk replication, which just came in just in time, really saved our ass there. Despite disk dying left and right, sometimes several disks a day, we did not lose any instance data. There was always a surviving copy elsewhere that got real-time replicated, that we could switch over to, replace the instance, the broken disks for the instance. The instance kept running, and before another disk died, we already had new copies. So we were able to pretty much keep ahead of the shark swimming behind us. No losses, nothing died. We were honestly very much surprised it worked that well. And then in 2007, the event happened that we had been preparing for quite some time, the open source release. In 2007.03.0, we posted a post into the Google code blog announcing the open source release. It's now living on codegoogle.com, and the development switched to the public subversion repository as hosted by code.google.com. Now, we had been using Perforce until that time. The Perforce setup we are using at Google uses a send patch review commit cycle. That is, you write your stuff, you write a patch, and you send a change list out for review. Now, somebody on your team, who hopefully understands what you're doing, reviews the code, and either says, okay, that looks good to me, you can commit it, or, yeah, that looks strange, could you fix that, and yeah, there's a typo over there, and fix that, and come back when you have fixed it. So once you get it looks good to me, the approval of your patch, you can go and commit it. Nothing goes into the repository unreviewed. That helps a lot with code quality. Now, Subversion doesn't support that model out of the box. So we ended up writing a few small tool scripts internally to actually give us the necessary infrastructure to keep using that model, because we wanted to keep it. Because it worked really well. So in August 2007, we finally released the first beta version of GNDI 1.2, and in December, GNDI 1.2 got finally released. The whole beta releases were already on the public repository and publicly released. You can still dig up the old tables on codegoogle.com. Over there, obviously deprecated by now. You can run them, but yeah, only if you are in the history. Things had grown to about almost 28,000 lines of code. Again, there were good reasons for it. So the OS API, you may remember, the instance S templates that are necessary and whose job it is to actually get something onto the instance disk that runs, that they use the OS API. They got more powerful. You could, instead of only create, you could create them, still, obviously. You could do an instance rename with optional support by the OS templates. So you could do something like, say you have an instance that got created, say, by dbootstrap or something, a Debian instance. There are a few places in EDC where the hostname is used, like EDC hostname, maybe Procrastix configuration, EDC host, stuff like that. So what you could do, write an instance OS template script that supported the rename operation. So it would get handed the instance disk, the instance name, and would go in, mount the instance file systems, and edit the files in place, unmount it. Nice. Otherwise, without that explicit support, you could still rename the instance, but there would be no change. The instance would still think of itself with its old name. You have to go in and change the files manually. They also supported import-export. What is that? Well, we added a GND backup tool. Oh, and by the way, the whole toolchain had by then changed to the GND name. So from xc-something, the commands changed to gnt-something. Yeah, nobody ever outside Google ever saw the xc stuff. Because that was 1.2 was the first public one. So GND backup had added the capability to export an instance, which meant shut it down, mount the disks, access the instance disks, export the instance disk data, I think as a jar GZ, or even as a plain dump, as well as a small file that contains the instance configuration. Stuffed it in the directory. That block you could take and copy it over, say, to another node, or to even an entire cluster by hand, and do a GNT instance import, and it would recreate your instance from that block of export data. We also added DRBD8 support, which for one thing, DRBD8 is way more stable than DRBD07. We had some, shall we say, fun with DRBD07, because DRBD07 has a very, very rudimentary error handling. So that is a specific situation where, where DRBD may lose access to both sides of the disk. The local disk goes away because it's broken. So the operating system says, the disk is broken offline, I'm not talking to it anymore. Fine, there are still the other disks that you can talk to via the network. Now some idiot pulls out the network plug. Just lost access to the other disk. You have no access to good data anymore. Now what would you expect the error handling should look like in that place? So I would say, yeah, no data, I/O error, and complain upwards. That's not the way DRBD07 worked. DRBD07 would just write to the syslog, I have no access to good data anymore, panic. And would panic the machine. That really, really, truly sucks if you have more than one instance running on that machine, which is the whole point of virtualization. Yeah, we had great fun with that. DRBD08 actually does proper error handling in that case and propagates I/O errors up the call tree, so the instance sees, oh, my disks are gone. But at least it only afflicts the instance whose disks have gone away and doesn't kill everything else. It is also way more stable, way faster, more shiny. It also resulted in us being able to simplify the device stack. Since DRBD07 didn't support real-time attachment and unattachment of block devices, we had to restart the block device for that, we had a more complex device stack. That also used the MD layer, so we could in real-time detach and reattach devices. That was a bit cumbersome and not much fun to debug. With DRBD8 we can in real-time replace the devices on the DRBD level. For the instance, it's still transparent, but it makes the device stack easier, makes the debugging easier, makes the whole stack way more robust. We also added tag support for all the objects, meaning cluster, node, and instance. Now, what is that doing? So you can add tags. For instance, say, a typical office setup would be you have, say, two DNS servers for redundancy. So if one dies, you still have another one. Fine. But if both are running on the same host, and that host dies, all your redundancy setup was just for naught. So you better have them running on two different machines. So we also had automatic allocation and movement tools by then, which I'm talking later on. So what could happen is that you would set up the cluster with the first DNS instance in one host, the other DNS server instance on the other host, and everything would be fine. Then that host would die, and you would automatically evacuate the host, get stuff out, and since the evacuation script didn't know any better, they would actually shovel both your DNS instances on the same node. That sucks. So we actually added the capability to add tags to them, so the tool could look, oh, those two instances are not supposed to be on the same node. It could make smarter decisions. Also, that allowed us to add various other monitoring information and stuff like that. We also added instance reinstall support. So until that point, if you wanted to reinstall instance, you would have to nuke it and do a full new install. Now you can just say, okay, reinstall it. Makes it a bit easier. Also, instance name support fully supported. The watcher got a few changes, and it actually now detects if a secondary has gone away and reactivates the disk. So basically, what could happen is, for some reason, a secondary node where your remote disk copy reboots, maybe something wrong with it, it comes back up, but the DRBD link is still broken. So the backup copy doesn't get updated. Now, at that point, the watcher actually detects that and re-establish that link, and your data gets synced again. We also added an instance disk upgrade tool. This was necessary because the on-disk data format between DRBD07 and DRBD8 changed. Now, you could do it the hard way and turn down your cluster, meaning destroy all the instances, throw everything away, uninstall the old kernel version, install the new kernel version, and do a cold setup again. Well, yes, you can do that. but sysadmins are notoriously lazy. So we wrote a script to deal with that. That basically goes in and changes the disks automatically to the new format. So we can pretty much do in-place updates. Yes, we have to shut everything down for that thing, because yeah, different DRBD driver, old module has to be unloaded and so on, but at least we don't have to rebuild everything. We can just shut things down, do the upgrade in place, start things again, way faster. Then at that point in time, our clusters were also growing quite a bit and becoming quite a bit larger than 2 or 4 nodes. So scalability became an issue. So we worked in scalability fixments, make things a bit faster, scale a bit better. We also added hooks. Now that is a nice feature. And at that point, every Gunnity operation, like instance create, instance start, or cluster verify, had the ability to add post and pre-hooks, which were external executables that could be executed before and after the operation. Could use them for things like local changes. So say do a GNT instance, we create a new instance. And it would be really nice if that instance got, say, automatically registered in the backup system and the monitoring system without you having to actually go out there yourself. So you could do that in a post hook for the instance install. GNT instance add and post hook goes out, it knows the instance name and talks to whatever system you have. It says, here is a new machine and please register it. Or you could do site-specific changes like that. And the Gunny 1.2 package is then went into Debian Unstable pretty much shortly after the release. And by now, Gunny is available via Debian. After the 1.2 release, things kept going. We actually started adding features as well. We added the HVM support, first experimentally, and then actually fully supported for production using Xen HVM, so you could actually run Windows on Gunnity, if for whatever reason you felt the need to do so. Yeah, well, there was actually a use case for that. We also improved actually cluster operations. We came up with the instance allocator. So that means you no longer have to look, okay, on which node do I have enough disk space and memory for this instance, and on which can I use as a secondary? You just use an automatic allocator that tries to do a best fit allocation. You say, okay, I need an instance with this much disk, this much VCPU, and that much memory. Put it somewhere where there's space. I don't want to think about it. Makes things a lot easier. We also added the ability to actually grow disks. Until then, that meant wanting more disk space meant, okay, throw away the instance, build a new one. That gets a bit wearing after a while. So at that point, so then you could do, okay, we just shut the instance down, grow the disks, start it again. Now you have more disk space. We added batched instance creation, as in, yeah, I have to turn up a cluster and I need to do 40 instance installs for that. Well, you could sit down and do them all one by one, grab some coffee, grab some more coffee, go eat something, come back, and then the day is over, you may be done or not. Or you could use the batcher. Write a file, it contains a list of instances, the instance specifications, as in which operating OS template to use, how is the instance named, memory, CPU, and so on. Feed that file to the batcher and just tell it, okay, here, do it, tell me when you're done, and now I can do something else. It's a stupid, repetitive job. Guess who's perfect at doing shit like that? Computers, not humans. So, it's the computer's job. Remember the matrix. Never send a human to do a machine's job. Also again, robustness fixes. So we have an operation that is cluster verify that basically goes to the cluster, both the configuration and the actual running cluster, and looks if things are reasonably shipshape. Detecting things like non-existing disks, instances are down, that are supposed to be up, and various other brokenness, and complains quite loudly about that. And of course, does an exit 0 if everything is fine, so you can use it in your monitoring. That could improve quite a bit. We also improved the logging to make debugging easier and troubleshooting easier. We added support for DRBD 82 and the usual pile of fixes that happen when you actually go and use some software that you have written. There's always something to be fixed. At that point, we got more and more feedback about Kennedy being picked up by external users and questions about the projects and support questions. And how does that work? And could you please add that feature? Quite nice. It was coming on quite nice. It was really nice. Now, our internal clusters were getting larger. Oh well. Then, so I've been using SVN for a while, and while it was maybe a bit better than Perforce, Subversion is not quite a perfect source control management system. So the development team started using Git SVN because we still had to use the Subversion repository. But Git is nicer. So Git SVN, it was. So now time came for Kennedy 2.0. Now we had seen quite a lot in terms of operations, things that can go wrong, things that can behave oddly, things that just plain suck when you have clusters that are a bit larger and so on. And Kennedy 2.0 was pretty much a very wide-ranging rewrite that massively changed internal structure. We also used the opportunity of a major release to change the code repository from Subversion to Git. It's now being hosted on gitkennedy.org, and you can just get it by do a git clone in that URL and get the full Git repository. Again, we use the same send, patch, review, and commit workflow, and with adapted scripts this time. So in May 2005, we released Kennedy 2.0. Code had grown again to about 55,000 lines of code. Just about the number. That number actually includes everything in the checked out package. So that means it includes configure scripts, documentation stuff, everything. So the actual kind of actual Python code is, with the current release, rawly half than that. There's a lot of documentation. So what happened? For one thing, the command line tools, which until now were actually doing the work, have been changed to being just plain dump frontends. They create a job, fire a job off to the master daemon, who actually takes care of getting things done, and they just talk to the master daemon. Could you tell me if it's done? Is it done yet? Is it done yet? Is it done yet? Is it done yet? Oh, it's done. Oh, fine. Now I can tell the user it's done. Which means that if you control C the frontend command, nothing bad happens. You just kill the frontend, but the operation is running in the background by the master. No problem. All done. All work again. Done by the master daemon, which in turn talks to the node daemons. So the master daemon that runs on the master is the central point of control, and every node runs a node daemon that actually does the real work on the node. Things like allocating logical volumes, starting instances, querying the node for various bits of information, and so on. We also added fine-grained locking. Up until that point, we used the big Kennedy lock. Any operation that would start would grab the global lock and hold it. That means strictly serialized operation. So that's not so much of an issue if you have, say, two nodes. If you have 10 nodes, it gets to be annoying. If you have 20 nodes, it really sucks. And beyond even more. Fine-grained locking actually made it possible for us to parallelize work because we only locked the parts that were actually changed. The DRBD07 support, which had already been deprecated, would finally drop at that point, and we only supported DRBD8. We also added KVM support and made it possible to actually mix hypervisors or hypervisor flavors and running Xen HVM and PVM on the same node in the same cluster. To add support for remote administration frameworks, we added a REST-based remote API that got secured by HTTPS. And of course, again, the necessary upgrade tools to move from 1.2.7 to 2.0. As I keep mentioning, there's a lot of operations actually driving development. Our internally deployed clusters are not that small. We are usually having tens of nodes in a cluster. And in total, four-digit number of instances. Yes, that is an official quote. And with the clusters that size, that means you have always something going on. That means you have quite a lot of instances. To pick a random number, you have, say, 5 or 6 instances per node, and you have 20 nodes. Yeah, that adds up. So if you have to do all the operations strictly serially, you spend an awesome amount of time just plain waiting. Bad. And with parallelization, you actually can do things in parallel and actually get things done a lot faster. Also, the cluster size is provided as a, to summarize it, special challenges. Because with that many machines and that many disks in them, that means shit breaks a lot more often. Plain maths. Yeah, main time between failure and divided by number of machines means, oh, things fail a lot faster in total. So there was a lot of stuff that went into improving repairs and making it easier to actually get things back in their working shape when, not if, hardware broke. So with Kinetic 2.0 XR, the minor sub-minor releases, there were things like adding support for striped logical volumes, so the actual logic volume could be striped over more than one physical volume. That means disk access gets a lot faster if you have the requisite number of free disks. Improved repairs, again, robustness fixes, and documentation updates, which are very much appreciated. And the new stuff, Kinetic 1.0 pretty much just released. We are now at 70,000 lines of code, which is quite a change from 4,000 lines when we started. Again, cluster repair infrastructure improvements, because that is one of the is one of the things basically we keep doing. Stuff fails, repaired. Stuff fails again, repaired again. And we also started doing things like automating it. If you do something for the umpteenth time, you start seeing patterns and notice, hey, I've been doing the same stuff again and again. Maybe I should automate it. Which is what we ended up doing. There is support for automated disk repair and automating as much of it as possible. We also added a new hypervisor, the Chainroot hypervisor. Oh, I wrote supervisor, okay. Basically, add Chainroot as a supported hypervisor type, probably useful for testing stuff. Also, the locking and parallelization got a lot improved, and the instances and the hypervisor support got way more flexible. You have now even more flex and bits that you can twiddle. Things like, for instance, for HVM, there are things like PAs, supporting physical address extension, supporting ACPI, changing various parameters, and documentation updates again. So what else will be happening? So we are still using the product quite intensively and expect to do so for quite some time. So it is getting developed further. What's currently in the works are cluster mergers. As in, I have these two clusters and it would be nice if I could merge them. I could do that the hard way and get everything off one node, drop it out of one cluster, and then do the other one. Yeah. Lots of work. Or have a tool that actually merges the clusters automatically. That is, I think, almost finished by now. Also, one of the requested features internally is inter-cluster instance transfers. I have an instance here, and for some reason I need it over there. Well, you could do that by now the manual way. Do an import, do an export into old cluster, grab SCP, copy the data over, and import it again. We now have a tool that actually automates that. We just say, okay, this instance, move it from this cluster over to the other one. Do it. And tell me when you're done. I don't want to know about it, otherwise it works. Well, currently being implemented. Also, again, the usual improvements in operations and maintenance. There's a bit more. There was a bit of development of supplementary code. There are the H tools. They were started during 1.2. I already mentioned when I talked about 1.2, the automatic evacuation and repair support stuff. That were the H tools. Originally, just a set of supplementary tools to automate things like evacuation, so you don't have to sit down with paper and pencil and start thinking, okay, how do I fit it in? Can I fit it there? No, but there's some space. We actually used to do it with pen and paper. I tell you, that gets really annoying, real fast. That's no fun. And it's the kind of thing, there are algorithms for it. So do it. But now it's grown quite a bit to actually support tools for the cluster operations. you can do instance creations, it supports repairs, it talks directly to the master daemon, and includes standard tester, cluster rebalancer, allocator, and capacity estimator. What does that do? Say, you have a cluster. One node failed, so you had it evacuated, everything got moved off. Node comes back from repairs, and now you have to get stuff back onto it. You could do it again manually. Maybe you wrote down what you shoveled off. But you still are likely to end up with unbalanced clusters. As in, there are two nodes that are totally overloaded. There are two nodes that are mostly idle. This one is empty. There is no space on that one. And ideally, you want all of the nodes reasonably balancedly loaded, reasonably equally loaded. That's what it does. Just tell it, this cluster, please balance it. So it goes in, grabs the state of the cluster, grabs the free capacity, computes a solution, and implements it. I'm talking directly to the Gonenti master daemon, and tells, okay, please move that instance over there, that one over there, and do live migration so the users don't even notice it when the instance moves around. And when it's done, you have a nicely balanced cluster, provided there is a solution. If you have no space, well, it can't do magic. It can't create disks out of thin air. But if you have the space, it will most likely find a solution. It also works as a very good automagic allocator, doing with a best fit strategy. So you don't end up overloading your cluster when allocating instances. You just said here, this instance back, allocate it, and do it cleverly. It does. Also works as a capacity estimator. I have those clusters, and I need to turn up 20 servers. Now, where do I place them? Well, again, either manually or, there's a tool for that that actually estimates there's about this much capacity in that cluster, this much in that cluster, so you can tell which cluster you drop it on, or you could wrap a tool around that and tell it, okay, put it on the cluster with the most capacity. And that stuff was not written in Python, but actually in Haskell. Pretty much performance reasons. Haskell may look strange, but it's damn fast if you do it right. So, yes, functional programming is actually useful for something. It's even useful for systems administration. When you're using hard problems, and bin packing is a hard problem. And functional programming fits that quite nicely. It's also available in the Gonenti repositories. Then there's the strange stuff, NBMA tools. That's the non-broadcast multiple access networking tools. Well, so the situation is like this. You have a cluster in a foreign network for some reason. The instances are supposed to be living in a different network from the local one. So you cannot just bridge the instance traffic into the local network. And you cannot give them local IPs, because they're for some reason. So what you do, you use the NBMA tools to also virtualize the network. You set up a virtual network for the instance traffic on top of the network. The instance traffic no longer gets just bridged out, but it gets properly routed. And using GRE encapsulation, using GRE tunnels, for the traffic. So you have GRE tunnels between the nodes and dedicated gateways to the target environment. I see you're shaking your head there, yeah. But yeah, it actually works. No, it's not that sick. Works surprisingly reasonably well. The usual list of URLs, actually the last two URLs you can just grab from the first one. It's all there. So, any questions? Yeah. Questions of course accepted in both.
Es ist ja langsam nicht mehr ganz von der Hand zu weisen, dass Xen so langsam am mehr oder weniger riechen ist und früher oder später ja wahrscheinlich tot sein wird. Wie sieht es denn eigentlich aus mit dem KVM-Support? Ist das dann jetzt so das, wo es hingehen wird? Ich meine, ihr habt ja sicherlich einige Xen-Instanzen, dass er nicht so schnell umsteigen werden könnt. Aber wie sieht es da mit dem Support eigentlich aus?
Also wenn Xen riecht, besorgt er den Nasenklammer. Nein, also ich muss sagen, Xen läuft ganz gut. Ich meine, die Entwicklung läuft nach wie vor. Und ich habe momentan die 3.4.2 im Test, die ist recht nett. Natürlich, die Frage, es besteht immer das Risiko, dass irgendwann das halt nicht mehr weiterentwickelt wird. Das war einer der Motivatoren dafür, den KVM-Support einzubauen. Also du kannst den Kanadi-Cluster auch ohne Probleme komplett mit KVM fahren. Das geht. KVM-Support ist komplett drin.
Wie ist das dann mit libvirt dann Unterstützung? Weil das ist ja dann quasi was Konkurrierendes, wenn man es so will.
Gar nicht.
Ja, also ich meine, irgendwie so als Interface, wenn man halt schon libvirt halt zum Beispiel hätte, dass es dann halt quasi distributed libvirt.
Nein, wir das Problem ist, mit libvirt würden wir uns eine weitere Dependency einfangen. Ich weiß auch nicht, inwieweit die libvirt denn wirklich zu unserem Modell passen würde. Inwieweit wir dann anfangen müssten mit Adapter-Layern, um den Impedance-Mismatch halbwegs hinzubiegen. Wir reden im Prinzip direkt mit den entsprechenden Tools. Und damit funktioniert das Ganze. Und dass wir jetzt eine externe Dependency haben, die nicht unter unserer Kontrolle steht. Weil dann kann es ja durchaus passieren, wenn du dafür eine externe Interface-Library nimmst, dass du dann den Jungs hinterher programmieren darfst. Und so, wenn es da Probleme gibt, die Kollegen, die das Zeug schreiben, sitzen hinter mir. Es macht es wesentlich einfacher, da mal zu schimpfen und das in Ordnung zu kriegen. Weitere Fragen? Dann möchte ich mich für die Aufmerksamkeit bedanken. Schönen Tag noch.